Well, today we're going to finish the story of Gideon in the book of Judges. We're going to look at chapter 8 in the book of Judges. And I want to set the stage a little bit before we start, because some of this moves fairly quickly, some of it moves fairly slowly. And I want to give you an idea of some of the background issues before we go, so that as I'm reading through, as we talk about it, some of it will make more sense to you if we can. The story of Gideon has a number of critical lessons to teach us. You know, we most often think about the fleece and how we, you know, look for signs from God. And that's certainly a lesson for us to understand. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. But there's a couple of other lessons in Gideon that we don't pay attention to very much. It's so usual for us to look at a biblical story and take the parts we want to focus on and study those, and ignore the other parts which we don't want to focus on because they may tell us a message we don't really want to hear. And I think that's the case for chapter 8 in the book of Judges. There are two parts remaining to this story, and they're related. The first part has to do with who are your friends and who are your enemies? That's kind of an interesting question, because I know for all of us, we think about that. You know, who are our friends and who are our enemies? Sometimes who you think is your enemy may not really be your worst enemy. And we're going to look at a little bit of that as we go through with Gideon. And the second part has to do with perhaps the worst enemy we face of all. And we'll get to that hopefully in the second half of this chapter. As you recall, where we left off, Gideon was called by God to go after the Midianites. And I think, as I mentioned to you once before, they're not on this map that I gave you earlier, but the Midianites are way down here, down on the southern part of Saudi Arabia, down on this side of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River and all of that. And it goes all the way down into the bottom. The Midianites are at the bottom. They're a nomadic tribe. They're probably one of the Bedouin tribes. You know, they would move on hillsides. They'd graze their sheep. And then when that played out, they'd move 50 miles down the road. They were also kind of a nomadic warring tribe. And anybody that had anything, they would go maraud, steal it, and bring it back home. And they didn't necessarily kill them all. They just robbed and plundered them. And we talked about the Israelites and how they had gotten used to 7 years of being pillaged by the Midianites. And they had gone up into the hills to hide, and anytime they came, and we saw Gideon trying to thresh wheat in a wine press because it was in the ground, and the Midianites couldn't see him threshing wheat. So he wanted to thresh that wheat so he could get bread to bake for his family before they re-escaped to the hills. So this whole culture around them was grown up in trying to protect themselves from the Midianites. And of course, part of that is the story of Gideon with the fleece and God calling him, and he understood it was God, but he wanted confirmation, and then God confirmed it with the first fleece, and then he wanted second confirmation, you know, which gives us an idea of kind of, when we know God is talking to us, when we know it's God who's speaking to us, how many times do we want to validate that before we go do what he's asked us to do?
Every time.
Well, we want to validate it once at least, right? So Gideon, like a lot of Jewish prophets and a lot of Jewish leaders, needed a sign, and God tells them they need a sign for everything, and so that works. Now, today we're going to see something play out right in this general area of the map, which is across the Jordan River into what would be now Jordan, but it was Ammon then, and there's a couple of the tribes that are over there, Gad and part of Asher and part, you know, a number of those. We'll talk about those as we get further along. So what happened was because of the Midianites had come over to camp out and they could see them, there was this whole story about paring the 32,000 down to 300. I'm not going to rehash all that, but God had Gideon get down to 300 people, and that's what he was going to attack, the 135,000 Midianites with 300. And so God gave him a plan, which was to divide up, to go stand around, take pottery jars, put the torches in the pottery jar so it couldn't be seen from the outside, sort of protect it and cover it, sneak up to the outside of the camp, take their shofars, their horns with them, and at Gideon's command, they were going to blow the shofar, they were going to break the pottery shards, pottery jar, and then hold the torches up and yell. And they did that, and of course, you know, God delivered them into the hands, but God had prepared the hearts of the Midianites. He had sown fear in there. He'd given a dream. And so God had prepared the enemy of Gideon for that deal. And of course, you know, 120,000 of them, they routed and they started killing each other. They couldn't tell who was who in the dark. Their camels stampeded. They had thousands and thousands of camels, and probably 20 or 30,000 of them were stampeded and killed by their own camels. So it was just chaos. And 15,000 of them escaped. And they were heading, or really more than that, probably 70 or 80,000. They were heading towards the Jordan River to go back home and escape. So they were over here, and they had to go across the Jordan to get back home and go south. And there's two or three places to ford the Jordan River. And so what Gideon did is send messengers ahead to Ephraim to come down and block the river and kill them at the river, which they did. But 15,000 of them squirted through with two of their leaders and went on up and head back to Midian. And that's kind of where we start today. And you'd think, I mean, just think about the whole thing. The Ephraimites have destroyed hundreds of them. They've caught the two leaders who are the military generals. They've cut their heads off. They brought them back as a prize to show that they'd actually done it. Gideon comes up and he crosses the river and gets into the territory of the Ephraimites. And that's where we begin chapter 8. And if you'll take a look at that, I want to read verse 1, then I want to talk about it. Now the Ephraimites asked Gideon, "Why have you treated us like this? Why didn't you call us when you went to fight Midian?" And they criticized him sharply. Some of your translations may have a little different wording there. I'll explain to you what it means to say they criticized him sharply. So why would they criticize him? What's the problem? Are the Ephraimites his enemy, or was it the Midianites? Hard to tell. We get a good clue of who the Ephraimites were. The Ephraimites were the descendants of Joseph. And, you know, they had very very important people that came out of their tribe. And they had the two main areas of worship that were in their territory, the territory of the Ephraimites. They had Shiloh, what the Hebrews call Shiloh. They had Shiloh, which was where the ark was, which was where all of the stuff was for the worship of God. And that's where the priesthood was. This is before it was all set up in Jerusalem. So it was all set up in Shiloh or Shiloh. And so that's where they had worship. And they also had a town called Bethel, or Bethel. Bethel means house of God. And that's where most of the worship took place, those two cities. So picture it like Saudi Arabia, who have Medina and whatever the other one is, the two big cities that are huge parts of Islam. Everybody from the Islamic world goes there for pilgrimage. Everybody from the Jewish world went to Ephraim for pilgrimage. They went to worship God there. They went to have the priests bless them, to have the ceremonies that the Jews do every year, the ceremony of the Passover. All that was done in their little makeshift temple there. And so they were very proud of themselves. They were the largest tribe. They were the most important tribe. They were the biggest tribe in terms of money, wealth, soldiers, everything about them. And what they're mad about is that God had pared down the soldiers to 300, and Gideon never called Ephraim to come join him. So they're ticked off because they think Gideon did it so that he could become the hero. Gideon did it so that he could take the glory. Gideon did it so that he could be named king. You know, Gideon did it for all the reasons that they wanted it for themselves. But, you know, we many times our own feelings we project on somebody else because we think this way, we think they think this way, and they don't. Gideon didn't think that way. So anyway, they accuse him. Why have you treated us like this? In other words, why didn't you let us? We're the powerful guys. We're the big kid on the block. We're the primo uno, you know. Why didn't you call us so we could be in on the deal? Maybe it was because they thought he wanted all the spoils himself. Maybe it was because, you know, again, he wanted to be king or whatever. Why didn't you call us when you went to fight Midian? The "you go to fight Midian" is kind of a interesting tell on them. They criticized him sharply. If you look in the text, in the end of verse 1, does your translation say something different besides they criticized him sharply?
Contended
with him vigorously. Furiously, vigorously. And what's the word before vigorous?
Contended with him.
Contended with him vigorously. So the NIV here sort of, there's two main points to this phrase. One is contended and one is vigorously or viciously. And so they were public about it. That contended with him means they were public. So they were yelling at him. They were screaming at him. Why did they do this to them? And it was a public deal in front of all his 300 troops, in front of however many they had. That's what's meant by the word contended with. And then it says, mine says criticized him sharply. Yours says vigorously. And that means it was near the point of violence. And you know, we see today, I mean, you don't have to go very far and watch a demonstration before you see the anger and the heat get to a point of violence. And it wouldn't take much to spark violence in some of the things that are happening in the world today. And Gideon, for all of his issues with God, responds in a way most of us wouldn't do. He responds in a very even-handed, calm way. You know, if you actually want to understand how to do this, there's many courses today where you can go get lessons on how to respond to hostile people. You know, you got to talk evenly, you can't inflame, you got to, you know, act like you're not, they didn't make you mad, you know, all the tricks of the trade. Well, Gideon knew those tricks, or he was told by God what to say, or maybe his own personality. You know, he could have said things like, "Well, I called on you once before and you wouldn't come. And oh, by the way, you know, God called me to do it. He didn't call you to do it." You know, now that would have set him off because 300 men versus however many tens of thousands they had. So he didn't do that. What he does is he replies to them in what one of the commentators calls tact. I don't know that I would use the word tact, but he does. And he says that the tact is really saying something, you know, it's kind of like somebody visits your house and you thank them for coming even though you wish they would go home. Maybe that's tact. Present company excluded. And so I don't know whether that's tact or not, but one of the commentators had a funny story by Chuck Swindoll. And you've probably heard this story before, but this in New York, this man and this wife, you know, had been married for a long, long time, and she was going to go with some friends on a tour to Europe. So she gets on the plane, she goes out to Kennedy, she flies off to Europe. She lands in Europe, and she calls him and says, "I arrived safely, how's everything at home?" And he says, "The cat died." And she goes, "Oh my gosh, you know, you have no tact, you're just blunt. You could have prepared me for it." And he said, like all husbands, he said, "Well, what could I have done better?" And so she listed out all the things he could have done better. "Well, you could have, you know, you could have waited till I landed in London and said, 'The cat's on the roof.' When I landed in, you know, Paris, you could have said, 'The cat fell off the roof.' You know, when I got to Rome, you could have said, 'The cat's at the vet and not doing well.' And then when I got to Germany, you could have said, 'The cat didn't make it.'" And he apologized, said he would learn tact, you know. And so they go on, everything's patched up, and she says, "Oh, how's my mom?" Uh-oh. And she says, "She's on the roof." And I thought, and he says, "That's not tact." But I thought it was funny. So anyway, I thought I would just share that. So Gideon uses tact here. He uses a little different deal. And what he said, what he says is, "What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't the gleanings of Ephraim's grapes better than the full grape harvest of Abiezer?" He's from the tribe of Abiezer, from the area of Abiezer. So what he's saying is, after you've picked the grapes, the stuff that's left in your field is better than our original harvest. You know, you guys are wonderful. You can probably hear the sucking sound. He's you know, sucking up to him, trying to make it better. And then he says, "God gave Oreb and Zeb, the two leaders, the Midianite leaders, into your hands. What was I able to do compared to you?" At this, their resentment against him subsided. So he diffused the situation, and he used very skillfully, although he did come back at the one area, which I read over and you probably didn't catch it. He does say, "God gave Oreb and Zeb, the Midianite leaders, into your hands." In other words, they thought they had done that, and they thought that Gideon had done the 300 people scattering, and he reminded them that it wasn't him and it wasn't them, it was God. God did both of them. And so Gideon, you know, took the brunt of their heat, diffused the situation, everything became happy, 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 and they moved on, except for the fact that he wanted to remind them that it wasn't him and it wasn't them, it was actually God. And so it says here, Gideon and his 300 men, exhausted, yet kept up the pursuit. They're looking for those 15,000 that got away. Came to the Jordan, crossed it, and said to the men of Succoth, or Succoth, "Give my troops some bread, and they are worn out. I am still pursuing Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." Now, this is too little. I'm going to read it quickly here. "But the officials of Succoth said, 'Do you already have the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops?'" You look at that and you think, what does that mean? "Then Gideon replied, 'Just for that, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars.'" He's the judge, remember, of Israel. "From there he went to Peniel and made the same request, but they answered as the men of Succoth had. So he said to the men of Peniel, 'When I return in triumph, I will tear down this tower.'" Now, let me make a point. He's gone across the Jordan River. So he's in what would be modern-day Jordan today, and these are the two of the tribes that are in the western half of that part of Israel. And they were very close to the Midianites. And what you quickly come to understand is they had been doing trade deals with the Midianites. The Midianites would come through to raid the Jews on the other side of the river, and they'd, you know, feed them, they'd sell them stuff, they'd trade with them. And they were not looking, they didn't care about their brothers on the other side. They were trying to survive in their own tribes. One of them, the ones in Peniel, had built a giant tower. And this tower is where if they ever had a trouble with the Midianites, they would go to the tower and hide because the Midianites couldn't get in the tower. So that was their stronghold. So what he's basically saying is, when I come back, I'm going to tear down your stronghold because you're depending on your relationship with the Midianites as opposed to God. Now, this whole thing about the hands is a Eastern custom, and I guess we look at the ISIS today and we see a lot of things we don't like about that. But what they used to do is, when they'd capture somebody, they'd cut their hands off and carry them with them as proof that they had killed them. So what these two tribes are saying is, if you don't have their hands with you now, we're not going to trade with you, because they're going to come back and they're going to kill us because we traded with the enemy, we traded with you. So Gideon knew that, of course. He didn't have the hands, but he was pursuing them. So he goes on, and he says in verse 10, "Now Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkor with a force of about 15,000 men, all that were left of the armies of the eastern people. 120,000 swordsmen had fallen." So it's pretty gruesome, but 120,000 of the 135,000 are dead. These are the 15,000 that are left. "Gideon went up by the route of the nomads." In other words, he followed the path of the Bedouins. He followed the goat herd path, as opposed to maybe the road, so he could sneak up on them. "And he fell upon the unsuspecting army. Zebah and Zalmunna, the two kings of Midian, fled, but he pursued them and captured them, routing their entire army. Gideon, son of Joash, then returned from battle by the pass of Heres. He caught a young man of Succoth and questioned him, and the young man wrote down for him the names of the 77 officials of Succoth, the elders of the town. Gideon came and said to the men, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna." So you wanted their hands, but I'm showing you their whole, the whole bodies of them, "about whom you taunted me by saying, 'Do you already have the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your exhausted men?' He took the elders of the town and taught the men of Succoth a lesson by punishing them with desert thorns and briars. He also pulled down the tower of Peniel, which is a little separate town, and killed the men of this town." So it's kind of an interesting judgment on them. But you know, God had put Gideon in charge of solving a problem for the Israelites, and these tribes were directly in blocking him, and so he executes judgment on them that God has given him authority to do. And then he talks to these two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. He said, "What kind of men did you kill at Tabor?" "Men like you," they answered, "each one with the bearing of a prince." Tabor is back in the area where Gideon is from. Gideon replies, "Those men were my brothers, the sons of my own mother. As surely as the Lord lives, if you had spared their lives, I would not kill you." Turning to Jether, his oldest son, he said, "Kill them." But Jether did not draw his sword because he was only a boy and was afraid. That probably means he was probably 12 or 13 years old. So he didn't want to get in that business. He'd been along with his dad, but he was not going to do that. So Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Come, do it yourself. As is the man, so is his strength." In other words, if you're such a big guy, if you're such an important guy, you come do it yourself. Don't have your son do it. So Gideon did. He stepped forward and killed them and took the ornaments off their camels' necks. Kings in that day not only wore fancy clothes, but their camels were decked out, you know, with all kinds of gold and stuff like that. It's kind of like having the Cadillac Escalade, you know. It's the big Escalade all dressed out, and you know, as opposed to the little Pinto or something that Gideon was driving. And so, you know, he takes all the implements off the camels, and you know, takes the camels and, you know, takes them as his spoils. So we've seen one aspect of this, and I guess I want to say, who is our enemy? Is it who we think it is, or is it our friends? Is it our brothers? Is it the people that we know? Of course, the trouble in the church is, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the trouble in the church is, you know, more people in the church are damaged by infighting between Christians than they are from the outside world. You know, if somebody comes against the church from the outside world, the church bands together pretty well. But we take a lot of sniping, a lot of friendly fire from inside the church. And that's sad. I mean, there's things that we ought to argue about.
Christians are the best at shooting their own wounded.
Shooting their own wounded, right. That's for sure. And so, you know, there's things we ought to argue about. There's things we ought to have discussions about. But, you know, after all, we are brothers and sisters in Christ. We ought to be able to have a conversation without, you know, going down the path of demeaning and names and, you know, violence and anger and all that. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. But anyway, that's just a thought for you to think about when you think about other things. So Gideon finishes this little escapade, and he comes home. And the Israelites say to Gideon, this is verse 22, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian." So he's basically been offered a dynasty. This is before David. He's been offered a dynasty, him, his sons, his grandsons, to rule over them as king. And, you know, because they said, because he had saved them from the Midianites. In verse 23, the highlight of Gideon's career, I might add, he says, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." And he said, "I do have..." Let me stop there. So if this story ended there, we would have a wonderful picture of Gideon. We'd have a guy who followed the Lord, who did what the Lord said, a little reluctantly perhaps, a little cowardly in some areas, but he did it. And the Lord honored him and gave him the victories in all that he did. And he brought salvation, he brought peace to Israel. We see that in the latter part of this verse. But that's not where the story stops. That's not where the, yeah, so the story continues. And this is the part of the story that we don't hear about. Preachers don't preach about, nobody teaches about this part of the story because this is not a good part of the story. But it's important for us. So Gideon says, I won't be your king, but I do have one request of you. He says that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder. It was customary of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. So these Bedouins were all Ishmaelites, and so they all had a gold earring. So as they killed them, they took their gold earrings. So they all had piles of gold earrings that they had taken. So what Gideon asked for is one of the gold earrings. And of course, they're happy as they can be to do that. Verse 25, they answered, we'll be glad to give them. So they spread out a garment. Each man threw a ring from his plunder onto it. The weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, not counting the ornaments, the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains that were on their camels' necks. Now, you look at that and you say, well, 300 shekels is not a lot of money with today's Israel shekel. But if you look at that time, that was what we would say are $300,000 or $400,000 worth of value today, you know, as we look at that. So it was not all of their plunder. They certainly had more than that, but it was a pretty good payment for Gideon. And this really started the downward slope for Gideon, because Gideon had really come off of the high horse of saying it was all God to begin to take payment personally for what had happened. And so Gideon made the gold into an ephod, which he placed in Ophrah, his town. Anyone know what an ephod is? Yeah, an ephod is a garment that the high priest wore. Not the breastplate. It's the garment that the breastplate goes in. And it's got pockets, and they had various things the high priest used. And it was made out of linen. And then the breastplate was made out of gold and jewels and that kind of stuff. So he made an ephod, which is, it's almost like an apron, if you will, a big apron, except it's made out of gold. And he makes it out of gold in his own city, which he placed in Ophrah, which is not the city of Shiloh, where the main worship is. It was his town. All Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there and became a snare to Gideon and his family. So in essence, what he did was the worship center for Israel was run by the Ephraimites. That's where the ark was. That's where all the worship was, Bethel, Shiloh. And he created his own worship garment, and he placed it in his own city, and people began to worship that as opposed to go where they should go and worship. And it says, all Israel prostituted themselves, in other words, went after a false god and a false process, worshiped it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. Now, that's we look at that and we read that and we think, oh, well, that's too bad. You know, he probably just was misguided and made a mistake here and there. But we see a little bit of different story of Gideon in the next part of this. So verse 28, thus Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land enjoyed peace for 40 years. So this is what I meant before, that Gideon's the last of the judges to bring peace to Israel, which is kind of interesting, for 40 years during the remainder of his life. Gideon was not an old man when he became the judge. He lived a long time. So during this time, during this 40 years, all this stuff was going on. Verse 29, it uses his nickname, Jerubbaal, which is that who opposes Baal. That's the nickname his father gave him, son of Joash, went back to his hometown. He had 70 sons of his own. 70 sons. For he had many wives. Now, if you read Deuteronomy, I'm not going to read it, but if you read Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, it says that the kings in Israel, leaders in Israel, kings in Israel, were not to have multiple wives. they were to have a single wife. Because if they had multiple wives, they would be led astray. Because you know, I'm not going to go down this path very far. But there were a lot of ways people made alliances. Just like in Europe, you know, you look at the kings of England, they are all descended from Germany, you know, or Prussia, or Austria, because they intermarried to give alliances, so they wouldn't, so their kingdoms would be protected. Well, in this particular area, you know, he had many wives, probably from the other tribes around there, but that's not the worst part of it. His concubine, his mistress, if you will, who lived in Shechem. Shechem is not even in this area. It's over in, it's a Canaanite town. So he had, you know, like a sailor, I guess he had a girl in another port, and this port was Shechem. And she produced a son for him, who he named Abimelech. Now, it says he named his son Abimelech. I'm going to wait and tell you what Abimelech means for just a minute. Gideon, son of Joash, died at the good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah in the Abiezerites. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal Berith as their god, and they did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal again is Gideon. That is Gideon, for all the good things he had done for them. So the pattern of judges is now the same. The judge does what God calls him. He routs them of the enemies. But as soon as he dies, they go back to doing what they're doing, except a little worse than the time before. So they fall back into this pattern again of doing bad things. And it doesn't take very long, because they've been going along for, you know, 40 years of peace, at which time this alternate worship is set up, this alternate place of looking for God is set up. So Israel was real confused, at least these tribes were, about who God was, who they were, who they worshiped, what they were called to do. All of this was confusing. Gideon was not a priest. Gideon wasn't of the house of Aaron. He couldn't be a priest. Yet he sort of made himself the high priest because of his making the ephod, and people looked up to him, and he sort of assumed a role that God had never given him. And so it was like so many today, you know, in the church or in cults or anything else, we become worshipful of a person and we follow what they say as opposed to if they're following God or not. And that's been a problem. It was a problem then, and it's a problem today. There are many people, you know, in the world today that, you know, sort of claim that they get a word from God. You know, and the word is kind of different than anything we've ever heard before. It doesn't fit with what we understand as Orthodox Christianity. But yet they've got a huge following. They make a lot of money. They're on TV. They do all kinds of stuff. And so it's not too much different today that alternate worship things are set up against God. But it is not looked upon kindly by God. God doesn't appreciate people going away from him worshiping other gods. So the term Abimelech means my father is a king. So he was named that by his father. So every time somebody talked about Abimelech, they talked about my father is a king. Just like when Jerubbaal was talked about, it was the Baal fighter, the Baal contender. His real name was Gideon, but his nickname was the Baal fighter. I don't know what Abimelech's real name was, but his nickname from his father is, my father's the king. So you see real quickly what happened to Gideon was, Gideon began, he didn't overtly go after God, but over time, the fact that he was wealthy, the fact that everything had gone his way, began to creep into his psyche, and he began to assume power that wasn't his, and he began to usurp God. And you know, we're going to see how this plays out. But Gideon, you know, dies, and God honors that, and he dies and is buried with his forefathers. And I'm just going to read you the first part of chapter 9.
Jim, there's the other side of that, too. Is really devout Christians that raise children in peace and prosperity, those children aren't devout Christians as devout as their parents were. It gets watered down as it goes along. Oh, it probably happened here, which is definitely happening in our country.
Oh, that's absolutely right. We're only a generation or two away from godlessness. In fact, you look at the statistics today and you see where millennials don't see any value in church. They don't want a church. They don't want anybody telling them what's true and what's not true. You know, they want to march to their own drummer. And they've been raised by a set of parents who probably thought it was the best thing to let their kids learn on their own, you know, without parental instruction. And all of this, I don't want to sound conspiratorially, but all of this really stems out of the 60s, you know, and all of the violence against authority of any kind in the church and God, and all of this drug culture that sort of emanated then has really permeated society. And I know it's moved in a lot of ways, but we're really reaping now the benefits, if you want to call them that, certainly the aftermath of what was set in place, you know, 57 years ago, and we're seeing now what had happened. It doesn't take many generations for that to come into effect, and I think Joe's right. That's the question here. 40 years of false worship really destroys a generation, and they said they didn't remember anything that Gideon had done, nor did they remember God for any of the things he'd done for them. No, they didn't. They felt secure and safe. We have certain prophecies about that in our Bible today that says when we feel that way, that's when the Lord, you know, will come. But it's kind of interesting. Abimelech sent to his mother's brothers in Shechem, in other words, his family, not the family of Gideon, and asked them to call all of his mother's clan, ask the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Jerubbaal's sons rule over to you, or have just one man? Remember, I am your flesh and blood. So he begins the undercurrent to take the supposed throne away from Gideon himself. And the other thing you'll read if you go back in Deuteronomy is the Israelites are warned never to have a king over them that's not one of them. Never to have a king over them that's not part of their clan, not a Jew, if you will. And so that's pretty important. Well, I'm going to stop there because I think it's kind of interesting. I want you to read chapter 9, and we'll do that next week. Any questions about anything? There's a lot of application, by the way, that you can make to the church today in terms of, you know, how we go about setting up alternate worship, how we go about assuming control, how we go about, you know, all the different things that people do. And I guess the question, maybe I've had a couple of notes here. Let me see if I can find them. I don't see them. But I think we get a habit where people think they personally deserve everyone's respect. You know, they personally deserve everyone's consideration. They personally deserve everyone's honor for who they are. They deserve all the privileges that come with their office, whatever it is. They deserve the wealth that comes with it. You know, it's kind of a you owe me kind of a mentality. We see that today in the world. You know, people who have no right to things think that the world owes them, the church owes them, the government owns them, we owe them, taxpayers. Or God, worse than that, God owes me. And I think that's really where we see Gideon today, and I think we can make application, and you can make it wherever those little list of things strike your fancy, but we see in today's world a lot of people who yearn for respect, but they don't want to give it to God. They don't want God to be honored for what he's doing. They want to be honored for what they're doing on behalf of God. And that's kind of a nebulous difference, but it does lead down the path that Gideon went on. So that's it. Any questions or comments, any thoughts?
That reminds me so much of what you said not too long ago about the young men coming out of seminary, and ladies too, to be pastors, how they've got their own mindset as to how they won't take over an older church. They won't start a new church of their own.
Yeah, that's a good point. There was an article, I guess, in Barna interviewing newly graduated seminarians, and along with being Calvinistic, which is a whole other issue, they also have their own idea of what a church is. They don't want to take over a church. They don't want to deal with the people. They want to start a new one and build it exactly the way they want it. You know, they don't, certain styles of worship, certain music, they don't want to do. And it's creating a real problem in churches today where a church like ours has a hard time finding a pastor because some of the young ones that come out of the seminary don't want a church like this. They want a church like Mountain Lake, or, you know, they want to build a church like Mountain Lake because it's all high energy and stuff like that. So it's kind of a difficult time. We're on the lucky side of it. We're a larger church. We can do things a little easier. But some of these real small churches where they have bivocational pastors, it's really hard to find somebody who's got the heart and the call to do what God's doing. And I think personally they're going to find them outside the seminary because the seminary doesn't do them a lot of good. I call it the cemetery because it teaches you, I mean, you know, you're supposed to witness to dead people, but when you become one of them, it's kind of hard to witness to them. You know, it's the land of the zombies. So anyway, that's my preaching for today. Thank you for sending me down that rabbit trail. Let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll dismiss. Lord, thank you for this time. Thank you for the example of Gideon. And Lord, we pray that we follow Gideon's example on the good side. But Lord, we do not become so impressed with ourselves that we begin to think we're doing things and it's not you. Lord, we need to be grateful for all you do for us. We need to be thankful and humble for the things you allow us to participate in. And Lord, we never want to forget that you're God and we're not. And we are simply your servants here trying to do the work you've called us to do. Lord, I pray for the service to come. I pray for the pastor as he preaches. I pray that his words are the words you've given him to preach to us today. Lord, I pray that the prayers, the singing, all that's done will be done to your honor and glory. And I pray it in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you all. You're welcome.
Thank you.